Hey now, welcome back to the Deadology Podcast from Pencil Hill Studio, New Paltz, New York. I'm your host, Howard Weiner. This is Season 2, Episode 42 of the podcast, and today, December 14th, 2024, we're going to go back in time to 1985 and the Grateful Dead's amazing performance in the Brendan Byrne Arena on November 10th. An amazing first set. Primarily, we're going to just dive into that first set, which has some of the best versions of classic songs. But before we do that, we have a little segment here with David A. Davis, who came out with his first book, The Economic History of the Grateful Dead. This is a Zoom call I had with him the other day. It's about 15 minutes long, and then we'll jump into the amazing performance by the Grateful Dead on November 10th, 1985. So let's go to the Zoom call with Dave. All right. We got an author with us, his first book. He's done a lot of writing on the internet, Grateful Seconds, a very cool blog page. I'm talking about Dave Davis. He was on the podcast once before, and his new book is called The Economic History of the Grateful Dead. Dave, welcome back to the show. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, Howard. Hope you're well too.
Yeah, everything's cool, man. So I got your book. Excellent. Just loaded with information, and it's a story that really it hasn't been told before. The economic history of the Grateful Dead. It's a completely different way of looking at their history. Very cool, and this book covers it all. I mean, it has tons of documents, has the whole story. I love it. It's going to be on my coffee table for a while. It's going to be there with Dead Base because it's the type of thing you can always keep going back to. So tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this project and a little bit about the book itself.
I have a pal, Joe, from Colorado, who runs the JGMP website on Jerry for the last million years. And he turned me on to the Grateful Dead Archive in Santa Cruz. And we went up there, took me up there in 22 for a week. And then later in the year, I went back for another week. So I spent 2 weeks at the Grateful Dead Archive. And they allowed me to take photos of pages in these boxes of all these financial documents they have. I took 3,000 pictures. I just sat there hour after hour. I knew what I wanted to find, knew what I wanted to look at. And then I took a couple years looking through that stuff and grabbing some other proprietary information from other places. And I put together this thing. That's a 30-year look at the rock and roll, mainly about the Dead, but also about other bands that were playing around the same time.
Yeah, no, that is good. I like the context. Obviously, the Grateful Dead story by itself is incredible, but everything is kind of in context here, like what's happening that year. I was looking at 1 year, 1986, and ZZ Top was the best-selling band. Yeah, so it's kind of cool.
I know, it's cool.
I couldn't believe that, you know, like not looking down at ZZ Top at all, but that they were number one was kind of surprising. And also with the Grateful Dead, like the fact that they were number one in 73, it shouldn't be a surprise with all the concerts they did in the stadiums, but it was a surprise because you think of the Grateful Dead, they really hadn't established themselves like Led Zeppelin or the Rolling Stones at that point. But even as soon as 1973, they're the number one. Am I correct? They were the number one that year? Am I
recording? Yeah. Well, they're just right above the Allman Brothers. And this is a book about the Dead, so the Dead win. But yeah. I mean, they were the first two, followed by Alice Cooper of all people. But the Dead being the top box office attraction in 1973, and this is based on total sale, ticket sales, not per concert, because bands like the Stones would usually sell three times as many tickets as the Dead on an average concert. But because the Dead played so many concerts and attracted so many fans, they were the number one act in 73. And I've never seen that reported anywhere else. I've never seen all these numbers. And the Grateful Dead were number four in 78 and 79. I mean, I went to a bunch of shows. I had no idea the Dead were that popular.
They've always had that kind of underground culture thing going. But if you think about it, 73, they did come off of Working Man's Dead, American Beauty, and Europe 72. So they did have a little bit of commercial success there, but still, this was their passion, playing and starting from such like well thought out roots, non-commercial. We're going to be non-commercial, but eventually everything changes, man.
But it's really interesting because I've been studying a lot of concert history, and you look at Dylan's first concert on the West Coast was at the Berklee Community Theater, where the Dead played like 18 times later. 3,000 people paid $3 in 1964, 10 grand. Dylan probably got five, and the Dead didn't make $5,000 from one show till like 5 years later. It's really interesting. Bands like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Dylan made so much money years before the Dead, but the Dead kept chugging along,
Yeah. Hey, that Dylan concert you mentioned is from 65. I think it's December. I can't remember the exact
No,
date.
no, 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 no. 64, February
Oh.
64. It was a very, it was a short tour of the West Coast.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I know he played somewhere in 65 with the Electric Band. It was either
Oh, yeah,
65.
sure.
Yeah. Wow. So, yeah, we getting off topic here with Dylan, man, but that definitely those Electric Dylan shows were incredible. What was the biggest grossing show the Grateful Dead ever did?
The biggest grossing show was in their last year in 95. There was a number of shows that they made about $700,000 as gig income. But the very last two shows that they played at Soldier Field, if you look at what the Dead actually got from all sources, they made $1 million per gig. And that was $700,000. Well, there are 60,000 people paid $30, and that's 1.8 million. And then they took off expenses, and the promoters got their piece. This is all on page 13 of my book. So the Dead got 700,000 for the gig, 158 for lights and sound, which is the production, 67,000 for the video, and another 80 from other things. And it was just over $1 million,
Wow.
which is really amazing since that was their last concert.
Yeah, and they were the amazing thing, they weren't even that great in the 90s, but the wheel just kept turning, man. They just kept getting more popular and more popular and making more money, and it's rolled straight into the sphere. And with what is it, Dead Forever? They're not Dead and Company anymore, Dead Forever.
I
And
don't know. I don't know that.
yeah.
What's really cool is that the Dead, through all these documents, I found out that Cameron, for the last 8 years of band, Cameron Sayers was there every day, splitting the money up for the Dead, and Amy Pollan was working for John Scheer Metropolitan, who was the Dead partner for the last 20 years of the band. But Amy and Cameron would like go in a room and they'd split up the money, and a lot of it's cash, and it's like, they had a cookie cutter. They created spreadsheets in the late 80s and early 90s, and they knew what they were doing. They were really professional for the last 10 years of the band.
Yeah, no, amazing. Hey, bring me back to the Grateful Dead archives, man, because I want to visit that one day. What was that like going in there? Besides all the financial records, what other stuff? Give us a little insight into the Grateful Dead archive, because I got to go there someday.
Yeah, if you say Grateful Dead Archive and you see Santa Cruz, they have a big list of all the items they have in there. And I didn't see any of the warehouse that have all the promotional material and things with the albums and all the cool stuff that they have that are listed there. I stuck with the financial business boxes that have stuff on concerts, merchandising. Once in a while, you find some weird stuff. And they're like, one of my favorite Dead managers, Richard Loren, who managed the Dead between 74 and 81, who's been living up in Maine the last 14 years. I talked to him a few times.
What wasn't he tied with Garcia? Like that was Garcia kind of brought
Oh
him in?
yeah.
Yeah.
Originally Liberace, and then David Grisman, and then his Jerry's manager from 72 to 74 up in Stinson, and then the Dead manager. And he did amazing things like bring them to Egypt, and kind of created the by hiring John Shearer, they created the their this like systematic way to tour and make money profitable, just tremendous stuff. And he had given away all his personal material with the Dead to the archives, and a lot of his stuff was so helpful for the late 70s when I went to the shows when I first started going to. I always tried to find documents in the archive that were like my show, how much they made at my show, you know. So
Oh yeah, definitely. It definitely sticks out a little more when it's something you were at and you're seeing that particular information. We talked about the Lewiston show. That was a big grossing show, right?
was the highest paid gig of 1980 for the band. And in the towards the end of my book, I have like four or five pages where I list the top five shows of each year from 66 to 95. I have all kinds of charts like that in my book. Like, here's the most expensive shows in terms of, setting up the shows. The most expensive shows tended to be ones that weren't in either a theater or an arena or even a stadium. They were the ones that are out in a big field, like Englishtown, Lewiston, Watkins Glen, because there's so much variables about you don't really know how many people are going to come. The promoters made a lot of money on those kind of shows, more than the Dead, because they were taking on more risk.
Yeah. Hey, the another thing which I found interesting, I was going through, there's so much stuff to go through here. The year 1977 was pretty interesting because you got Englishtown, the contrast, you got that where they're making a ton of money, and then everything else is smaller. I didn't even think of it. Like, they played so many small arenas that year. It's like such a storied and great year. But they were doing Cornell, all the colleges, and Colgate, and so that was.
Oh, that's fascinating stuff, because like if you look at those great shows they played in Florida, like Lakeland and Pembroke Pines, the Dead, they had to actually give money back to their promoters because there were so few people at those shows. I can't
Wow.
even believe it. And so they would like, okay, we got a guarantee of $10,000, but we're going to give 5,000 back to the promoters, which was one of the really cool things the Dead did. They had free shows, but they were always really fair. And so if they'd share the wealth, they'd share the pain.
Wow, that's interesting because most bands, they're one of the few bands that would do that, give money back to the promoters.
Oh yeah, and a lot of that had to do with, I mean, they had a really good relationship with John Scheer. Now, Bill Graham, in my book, I talk about him being like a frenemy of the band. The thing about Bill Graham, he definitely grabbed money out of the shows from the Dead. I don't know what you want to call that, because it's the music business. They all do that, right?
Yeah.
But he also got them more money. He would negotiate better deals. So the Dead, he was like their devil. It's better to do business with Bill Graham out in the California shows, because he would get them more money, even though he might like keep the promotion money and things like that.
Yeah, Bill Graham is a one of a kind character, but he definitely did great by Santana, the Dead.
Sure.
He did
But
so right
but
by people, but he was tough. He was a businessman. There was a he had a many sides to Bill Graham, but overall he basically did a great job for the music world, and
I
he was
agree.
tough
I
as
agree.
hell.
Yeah, but John Scheer and Amy Pollan was the liaison between Metropolitan and the Dead for 20 years, from 76 to
Wow.
95. She's still out there. She's great. She offers me really interesting information now.
I'm sorry, who was that? I heard John Shipp.
No, Amy Pollan, who works with
Okay.
John Scheer. No, he wouldn't talk to me during my book because she didn't know me from Adam. I
Right.
had never written a book, but after I sent her a copy of the book, she was happy to tell me a few things. So, a very nice person.
Yeah, hey. Yeah, John shared. He was on all the ticket stubs, and I remember like ripping up a Ticketron stub, and it always had John Scheer's name on it, Capitol Theater. Another like crazy thing. I'm looking through the book. There's so much. I didn't even know where to go while I was speaking to you because there was so much interesting stuff. One of these late Garcia band tours. I think it was like '94. What did Jerry? That like they grossed like 3 or 4 million or something, or.
Yeah, I think in one year the Dead were number one and Jerry Band was like number two tour. I mean,
Wow.
number 10. And The Jerry band, this is an interesting area because Jerry wasn't like one of those guys who has a band and he keeps 90% of the money and he everyone else is like on the payroll. You know, they're being paid per gig. Jerry could have always done that, even starting in 75 when he created the Jerry Garcia Band. He went out on tour. He didn't have to give Nicky and, you know, John Conn, Ron Todd, he didn't have to give those guys like equal share, which Jerry did, like, I think to the end. Jerry was, he didn't care about money, you know?
No, it was very cool. I did an interview with Ozzy Ahlers, who played keyboards with him in 79 and 80, and that was one thing he said. Even in his will, he put something in there where the band members would get equal cut of whatever sales came after he passed away and stuff like that. So Ozzy Ahlers was like, this guy was incredible in the way he shared money. And he definitely gave his name, this is what Ozzy said, his name was on the marquee, but he split everything four ways with the guys in the band, and
Yeah, I'll tell you one interesting part about that. And one of the best things about my book, from my point of view, is like I was a financial advisor. I never would believe anybody who worked at a company telling me stuff, presidents and all that. They would, because they're salesmen. And I always said the documents speak for themselves. So you read off these documents, the numbers, you figure out what they're doing. That I don't need to go out and talk to a bunch of dead guys because the dead guys have been talked to for like 50 books. You know, they don't want to talk anymore to do this. So for me, it was good because I just relied on the documents.
Oh yeah, definitely, man. The book, like, that's one thing. Like, you do a nice job. You got the narrative, and then the documents to back it up. There's the documents from the archive. So that part is very cool. And like I said, this is kind of like a dead base of economic history. So it's like I said, this is definitely a coffee table book. Something all deadheads should have. It's whenever you listen, it's just interesting to see a different perspective on the shows. Everybody knows about the reviews and everything else, but this is a different look at the history of the Grateful Dead, man. I love it. We got a couple of minutes left. Anything else you want to mention about the book?
One last thing. So in 75, Richard Loren was talking about before, he came up with this plan that when the dead come out of retirement from 74, they should have two shows a night, kind of like the Garcia band, early show, late show, 2 hour shows. And he figured out some economic model where they were going to make so much money. I mean, more than the Dead, the more than they made on those 76 and 77 tours. But the Dead, of course, said, "Now we're not going to charge our fans twice in one night." You know, I thought that was great to see stuff like that. It's all stuff I'd never heard of. Nobody's ever talked about. So it's
Very cool.
fun.
But only Jerry Garcia band could get away with charging them twice in one night, and nobody complained, man, because you're paying $8 a ticket. And cool stuff, man. But interesting how all there's so much in this book. Like, I looked through it. I read a good portion of it, man. But it's something you have to keep going back to. Tons of excellent material in here. Great job. Congratulations on your first book. And
Thank you, Howard.
hey, my pleasure to have you on the podcast again. Tell everybody where they can find the book again. Pretty much, I got Amazon is the main
Amazon, you can get it. It's $35. The Economic History of the Grateful Dead by David A. Davis. You'll find it. And I'm also have a box of first edition. Author signed books, and I'll personalize them if you want that I can send you off from me. Send them off priority mail. It's close to Christmas, and if you want to get those, you contact me at davidadavis@gmail.com, and my Venmo is let this guy in free.
Nice Venmo handle. Hey, cool stuff, man. And hey, thanks for coming on again. Best wishes, good luck with the book, and I have a feeling we're going to get you back on the podcast for something. So thanks for joining us again, and peace out, brother.
Anytime, anytime, Howard. Thanks a lot. Have a nice night.
Hey, no problem. Thank you. Bye bye.
Bye.
All right, let's get on with the show. The Grateful Dead's November 10th, 1985 performance in the Brendan Byrne Arena. A longtime favorite tape slash CD of mine. It has three of the greatest performances of songs. Two are definite. The Cassidy and the Feel Like a Stranger, definitely the best ever versions. And Stagger Lee is my favorite. May not be the greatest. It could be. Not sure about how I go about ranking Stagger Lee's, but it's certainly my favorite version. So that alone right there makes this an extraordinary show. So, it was a pretty cool tour. The November 85, you got the Richmond shows. I think it was Columbus before that. The Richmond shows were two of the better shows. They played in Worcester. Famously, Bill Walton went there with a bunch of Celtics, including Larry Bird. Those shows were not quite as good as some of the other shows from the tour, in my opinion. Then you had the Rochester shows, two nights in Rochester before the final two shows of the Brendan Byrne here. Rochester, November 7th and 8th, great shows, man, just solid all the way through. And then we're heading into the Brendan Byrne Arena, November 10th and 11th to close out the tour. The Brendan Byrne had become like the Dead's kind of de facto New York area arena when Madison Square Garden, when they couldn't play Madison Square Garden, which led him to the Brendan Byrne 3 years in a row. The Dead tended to do more shows in Brendan Byrne than Nassau Coliseum for a while as the New York area arena. So Brendan Byrne definitely carried on the tradition of New York energy, especially on this night. So I go there with my friend Phil. We're with a couple of ladies that night. Walk up to the, try to get into the show. There is a line like I'd never seen at a Grateful Dead show before. And it moved in so slow. And there was almost like a little fear. It was like tight. It was almost, you think of Cincinnati where nine people got killed, trampled, trying to get into a Who concert. This was the only thing that even remotely felt dangerous in all my years trying to get into Grateful Dead shows. We missed the first two songs and got in during a third song. It was just a horrible job by the Brendan Byrne security that night. Just, people were dying to get in, and there was almost a little bit of a crush trying to get in there. So, we made it in. Once we got in, it was a relief. And I think the band definitely picked up on the hyped up energy on this night. So, we missed the first two songs, Touch of Grey and Hell in a Bucket. Obviously, In the Dark hadn't come out yet, but by this time, these songs were pretty good and people were really digging them. Good, high-energy versions. Bobby messes up the lyrics in Hell in a Bucket, but the jamming's pretty good, so we're off to a nice start. And then Sugar Ree. That would have been my ideal choice for the third song. We caught the end of the Sugar Ree when we walked in. Now it's an okay version. Some pretty hot licks by Jerry in the third instrumental. But the best days for Sugar Ree's, we didn't even realize at the time, were probably behind us. This one's not as good as the one from Springfield, Massachusetts on March 25th, 85. That's an absolute killer Sugar Ree. I think it's the last truly superb Sugar Ree that the Grateful Dead played. I think all the great versions, probably the top 20 versions of Sugar Ree, are all between 1977 and that Springfield 1985 show. But it was a good Sugar Ree. The Dead definitely had some energy going on this night, but they saved their best for me and Phil coming into the place, man, because song four, me and Phil just looked at each other. We're saying to each other, Cassidy, Cassidy, we're rooting for it. And they broke into Cassidy. We were pretty psyched. The only person in the building more psyched than us was Bob Weir. If you don't know this version, you got to hear it. It's the version that's on, they actually selected this for a box set, So Many Roads. I know David Gans and the late Steve Silberman were instrumental in selecting different cuts for this box set. And when I saw the Cassidy from November 10th, 85, very happy to see it as part of the box set because it is the greatest version of Cassidy ever. And Bob Weir just, sings it with such intensity at the beginning, unlike any other. It's just like the emotion and also the cadence he delivers, man, just incredible. And you know, Jerry just picks up on it. The band is doing incredible things here. And this jam is obviously what makes it. Let's go to our first audio highlight of the podcast. This is the instrumental of Cassidy. Enjoy. Let the words be yours, I'm done with mine. Hope you like your Grateful Dead Kung Pao Hot, because that's what that was, man. Incredible version of Cassidy. Undeniable Grateful Dead magic at work there. And hard to even explain what's going on there. So much, just like all the musicians are on top of their game, playing kind of almost out of control, but yet they have the synergy going where they're somehow listening to each other. It's pretty incredible. With that particular version, and sometimes like what the Grateful Dead are best at doing is like kind of drawing the jam back, like loading it up like a slingshot, which is definitely what it sounds like here at the beginning of Cassidy, kind of taking the music, pulling it into a vortex, just to give it more impact when they come through at the end. And unbelievable version of Cassidy. Everything you want is in there, man. Brent's playing on this night. You could really hear how great Brent is as a band member. Just the way he fills in with those keyboard licks all the way through. Just incredible magic. Phil, the drummer's pounding away. It's nothing like that, man. And the good thing is we have two other all-time kind of great versions as part of this first set. One of them follows right on the heels of Stranger, man. Just there's going to be no let up in the intensity here. They're on some kind of magical roll. And usually there's a few seconds break between songs here, but Jerry's ready. The song's over. Jerry can't wait to start singing Stagger Lee. He steps right up and they're into Stagger Lee. And there's just like a liquid lightning feel to this. At this point, you know, the show has taken, it started off good, but it's taken, they're on another level right now. They're playing as good as they could play. And this is my favorite version of Stagger Lee. There might be a couple better ones. I haven't done a complete thorough study on all the versions of Stagger Lee, and there's not a lot of great variations between versions. But this one has something, man. Just the way Jerry's singing, the sharpness of his guitar licks. And once again, let's go better than me explaining. Let's go back to the audio highlights. Check out the end of the Stagger Lee, the way Jerry's playing, the tone of his guitar, the purity and excitement in his singing. Incredible stuff.
Bye, yo. Bye. Different tune, what too could that be? The song that did his son, look out, Stagger Lee. Son, and woman, son, look out, Stagger Lee.
You gotta love the way Jerry belts that out, man. Stagger Lee. Fifth song of the first set, November 10th, 85, in the Brendan Byrne, East Rutherford, New Jersey. And, yeah, the Grateful Dead just had a way of taking these traditional songs, Jack Roe, Deep Ellum, and making it their own. You listen to the Grateful Dead do this, it doesn't even sound like it's a traditional song. They just have a way of breathing new life into it, especially when Jerry would do a cover of anybody's songs, whether it's Dylan or traditional. He just had a way of putting a unique spin on it that was distinctive, but yet very respectful of kind of how the original tune is meant to go. And next up, perfect lead in Bob Weir, when he would cover things, and they were more towards what the original were. He still does a great job with all his Dylan songs. And especially on this next song coming up, It's All Over Now, which was the sixth song in the Brendan Byrne Arena. This is a tight version, pretty cool. I've always liked It's All Over Now. I remember it was on one of the first tapes I had from the Shrine Auditorium, 76. That's an awesome version. Over the years, it seemed to become a little drawn out. It wasn't always the most thrilling song at times. I felt they could, at times, play it a little too long, go to the slide, back to Jerry. Sometimes it felt a little too long, but this version has like a perfect tempo, and yeah, they're popping on this night, man. They got the New York City energy running through the Brendan Byrne Arena, Grateful Dead on fire, very cool. It's All Over Now. Did all my comments for Road Jimmy. Once again, it's one of those songs that could take up a lot of time, and especially towards the end, get a little repetitive. Singing Row Jimmy Row over and over again, which in a way is beautiful to get lost into that mesmerizing flow. But this version, once again, just a little crisper and a little more pop to Jerry's voice. This is one of his best 1985 singing performances all the way through. Jerry very strong vocally on this night. Little growl, but it's a cool sounding growl. And so that brings us seven songs into the set. We're getting close to the end. And I just remember being there with Phil, and we thought we heard Stranger. And we're looking at each other, and we're thinking they're going to do Feel Like a Stranger to close out the set. This is going to be freaking incredibly hot. And we were like high-fiving each other because we could hear them warming up, and we knew it was going to be Stranger. And there was just a knowing that this was going to be a great version. It's hard to get that feeling. You know, sometimes they just pop out of nowhere. But at this point, I mean, we were convinced. We were so excited. It's like we knew this was going to be a ridiculous version. And it exceeded anything anybody had ever heard before and Feel Like a Stranger. It's that good. So, yeah, a cosmic explosion was imminent. And they break into Feel Like a Stranger. And this jam is probably even better than the one from Cassidy. But you could hear all the way through, we're doing some pretty cool stuff with the whammy bar. Garcia's turning knobs, you know, getting different sounds out of his guitar. The band's just like on this unbelievably experimental level, but they're actually listening to each other and feeding off of each other, which didn't happen as much in these years. But this is just an extraordinary version. The band's timing, so early on, it's pretty cool. Weir is having a really excited singing night, not the where he's doing the falsetto singing, but there's just brutal pushing across excitement to his vocal performances on this night. And he does like a cool "Let's get on with the show, let's go," and the crowd's going nuts. And as they go into the final sing off, Jerry jumps in too quickly. It would Feel Like a Stranger, but it's beautiful, man. It's like a little signature mistake, which sounds great, man. You wouldn't remove it if you could. Jerry's singing that Feel Like a Stranger part beautifully. Brent and Bobby got their thing going. And then there's the jam. And let's jump right into that.
Long, long, crazy, crazy night. Feel like a stranger. Gonna be a long, long, crazy, crazy night.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. Y'all hang with us.
Good God, that's LOL hot. I actually had to stop laughing before I could come back and comment on it, man. Just what a ultimate peak way to end the set on an instrumental. Incredible. You can't go on a higher peak than that, man. Grateful Dead magic at its best again. The band's timing, just beautiful. And so Jerry jumps in there like right away. Jerry's red hot and the band's right with him. And then it becomes, it's kind of difficult to keep, once you start at a high point, tough to keep raising as the song rolls along. Ideally, what you want to do is you want to keep it getting hotter and hotter. So it's unusual that he jumps in that hot. But somehow this version, but when you don't think it could take another level up, it does. And just the way Phil and the drummers are coming in at every... It's like Jerry was doing things he never did before, but everybody in the band was reading exactly what he was doing, as impossible as that sounds. And just some brilliant music. I definitely think it's the best Feel Like a Stranger of all time. And on a song that's very difficult to really nail the jam all the way through. I think there's a lot of strangers out there where they get part of the jam and they go back into the ending and never really peaked out. This one is the ultimate version, just over the top all the way through. Brilliant stuff there by the Grateful Dead. 8-song first set, one of the best tape and a CD that I went back to ever since that night. It's up there as one of my favorite sets to listen to. Just incredible. So we go to set 2 in the Brendan Byrne Arena. And right off the bat, you know it's not going to be anywhere near as good as set 1. So they came out, they gave it a good try to start set 2. There's definitely good intentions here. They go into half step and then they transition to I Know You Rider. And I'm sure people were thrilled with it that night. I wouldn't say I was thrilled with it because neither version is that great. But it's cool that they tried this. So the half step, Mississippi half step on this night was a few seconds under 7 minutes. Now, just think about like the Englishtown version, an 18-minute Mississippi half step. All the great half steps from 77, 78, 12 to 16 minutes long. So these, in the middle of the 80s, they had these quick dash half steps where they were just trying to set a speed record getting through it for some reason. They kind of fell out of touch with it. I think it was when they brought back Help on the Way, Slipknot, Franklin's, they started doing half step. Let me bring that back again. When they stopped doing Help on the Way, Slipknot, Franklin's in 77, they kind of went for a half step Franklin's thing, which kind of shortened half step. And then they got away from doing half step altogether. So it took them a while to get it back. In 1988, they played some very cool versions where they kind of recaptured the magic of half step. But in the middle of the 80s, when they did play it, it was just a speed race through the song. That being said, I enjoyed the hell out of it as I listened to it. But critically, it's not a good half step because you're losing all the guitar jams. So half step into Rider, it didn't flow right. As exciting as it may have been to hear I Know You Rider, something missed. It might be the same. They might be using the same chord progression that would have justified linking these songs, but when I listen to this, it just doesn't work. So half step, Rider, but the Grateful Dead, their experiment and what they were doing, especially as the 80s, the end of the 70s, the 80s rolled along, it took so much, I guess courage is the word, so much chutzpah to go out there and mix up these set lists like that. In the early days, they would always fall back on their great songs. Even if they didn't play Sugar Mag every night, they would play it every other night. Dark Star one night, other one the next night. So they didn't have quite as big a song repertoire, so they always could go back to the old reliables night after night. When the late 70s, early 80s come around, their strategy evolved even more. If they're doing an 11-show tour, Scarlet Begonias, Fire in the Mountains only going to be played 3 times. Morning Dew, you might get once or twice. China Cat Rider, you're going to get three times. So they had to constantly be coming up with these great set lists, figuring out how to try out different things and put the ingredients together. So I think that led to some extraordinary things that never would have happened, but also left us some playing which was a little iffy, like this Half Step Rider, which was an attempt, but it didn't work out that great. So they go back after Half Step Rider to playing Uncle John's, a classic combination. This is good. They definitely have, especially in this period, I've heard a lot better from both. Garcia's playing is pretty wicked in this playing, but too short. Uncle John's is decent. And this is a pretty good era for Uncle John's. They had a lot of hot versions. Augusta, October 12th, 1984. Fantastic Uncle John's band. And there's several of them in this period. This is not one of them. You could hear there's energy in their playing. This certainly isn't off stuff, but it's not noteworthy or great either. And then what I thought as I was listening to this, obviously I've listened to the first set a lot more than the second set. So in the podcast, I was hoping to catch something that would surprise me about the second set that I would like. And I saw that Uncle John's went into a supplication jam. I'm like, that must be freaking hot. And as I'm listening, it really wasn't. They did a little supplication jam, but it wasn't much. The supplication jams from this period, they stopped playing Lazy Lightning. So basically, you would just get a supplication jam here and there. Usually, they were pretty hot. This one, it's kind of like, at this point, the band's just, they're searching. Yeah, they have really not a lot going on. They play the supplication, but it might be the worst supplication jam I've ever heard. It really goes nowhere, and they go into drums in space. Now, just before I go on to the post-drums bit here, in spite of what I'm going to be saying about this second set, on this tour, I would say this is the fifth best show of the tour. I would go the two Richmonds are better, the two Rochesters are better. I haven't figured out how exactly I would rank those, but those are four shows, for starters, that are better. This will probably be fifth, all on the strength of the first set. And here's the weird thing. I'm going to throw this hypothetical situation out at you. Let's say the Grateful Dead, for some reason, couldn't put their stuff out on the internet anymore. They said, but as a last reward for our great Deadhead fans, you could pick one show out of every tour to download, and then we have to take this thing off the internet. If I had to pick one show to download off of this tour that I would never give up, it would be this show right here. That's how hot the Cassidy, Stranger, and Staggered Lee are. Even though I would rank this either like, you know, fifth or sixth best show of the tour, it would be the one that I would keep over any other. It's extraordinary that the playing in those songs just elevates this show to a must-have level. This tape is crazy, like where it's been in my life at certain points, I just want to bring up a quick story about 9/11. This was the last tape I heard before 9/11. I was in New York City that morning. So the most unforgettable thing was my last great moment of joy before seeing the tragedy of 9/11 unfold. I'm going to work. I sold copiers in the garment district of New York. Skipping down the street, it's the most beautiful day. I got a shirt on, a dress shirt, Jerry Garcia tie, purple Jerry Garcia tie, and I'm listening to a Walkman. I had a cassette tape. Part of my Grateful Dead collection was on CDs. A lot of them hadn't been on CDs yet or been available online. Still the early days of downloading stuff on the internet. So I have a tape of this show, and I just remember that morning of 9/11. I was the happiest person in New York City, not just because I was listening to this great show and enjoying the Cassidy and Feel Like a Stranger as I walked to the subway and rode the subway, but Bob Dylan's Love and Theft was coming out that morning. And the first thing I was doing after checking into the office was going to Nobody Beats the Wiz to buy the Dylan album with my manager. We had it all planned out. And then we saw on TV, obviously, the tragedy, you're not going to believe this, a plane hit the World Trade Center. So we were about a mile from the Trade Center, but you could clearly see it. I never took in the view of it. We just saw the one tower. And then standing in the street before we went to the Wiz we saw the explosion of the second plane coming in. And man, it was just like, so I went from like the highest, just early morning high you could have to just the reality of the new world and, you know, that they're going to be in. But it's cool that the last part of my pre-9/11 thing was hearing that Brendan Byrne Arena show. And we actually picked up, my boss was cool, man, great guy. We picked up Love and Theft. And the reason we actually went through with buying it that morning was we wanted to see what was happening on TV. And the Wiz had, you know, obviously a bunch of TVs in there. And I never listened to another song on 9/11. That was, you know, we didn't listen to the Dylan album. That was the last thing on anybody's mind on September 11th as you're watching things unfold. But yeah, just a great memory of a world of innocence and how the world changed after that. You know, this tape has like that kind of meaning for me. So moving on, drum space, and we can move on pretty quickly because it's not that great of a post drums. There's a couple of okay moments in here. We got Space, Truckin', Comes a Time. And Comes a Time was always a rare song to catch, and this one is kind of moving along pretty good. Once again, Jerry had a very good singing night all the way through, so it's a cool Comes a Time, very hot solo in the middle, but for some reason, as they go to the outro solo, Weir cut them off quick and went into a round and around. Usually, I mean, there's songs like Wharf Rat or Stella Blue where it wasn't unusual that Weir or whoever would make the decision would cut the solo pretty quickly in the 80s, but Comes a Time that usually there was a respect to let that last jam resonate, but on this one, unfortunately, I got cut too quickly. Around and Around, Good Lovin', to close out, and you know it was good, but at this point things felt just a little not exactly right. Things weren't, you know, cooking exactly right at this point with the show, so it was kind of like going through the motions. Around and Around and Good Lovin', and the encore to top off a brilliant singing night for Garcia, It's All Over Now, Baby Blue. Excellent version. That's going to be the outro tonight. I'm going to play the whole version of It's All Over Now, Baby Blue. And I could have been able to enjoy this quite a bit, even though I don't listen to the second set, because on the Charlie Miller download, which I listened to on, what would they call that? Re-Listen app. The Re-Listen app is my life. There was about a couple months ago, Re-Listen was, and the Grateful Dead internet, I think the whole thing was down for about a week, and I was lost, man. I was like a lost sailor out there, but luckily it got hacked, but now luckily it was restored, and the Charlie Miller version has Baby Blue, the encore, right after the Feel Like a Stranger, so obviously I could just easily enjoy that Baby Blue after hearing the hot Stranger. So this is an amazing version of Baby Blue. Jerry just beautiful, man, is singing on this night, incredible. So it's a very good way to end it out. But as I said, the first set and those great versions are so huge that this is just an immense show. If nothing else, listen to that entire first set. Great first set. And that will wrap up the November 10th, 85 review. I want to thank Dave Davis for joining me today. His new book, Economic History of the Grateful Dead, available on Amazon. And next week, I'm pretty sure I'm going to go for some Garcia band, some early days of the Jerry Garcia Quartet with Ozzy Allers and John Kahn. We're going to do December 21st, 1979 from Palo Alto. Just unbelievable, one of the best Garcia shows ever. Killer versions of Sugary and Positively 4th Street. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Howard Weiner. My website, tangledupintunes.com. All my books are on there. These books make nice stocking stuffers. Just pop a 300-page book right into the old Christmas stocking. And available on Tangled Up on Amazon, Tangled Up in Tunes. So hey, thanks for listening. Looking forward to doing this again next week. And don't forget to strike another match and start anew, because it's all over now, Baby Blue. Thank you.
room in the clothes that you once wore. Strike another match, go start anew. And it's all over now, baby blue. It's all over now, baby blue. It's all over now, baby blue. Yes, it's all over now, baby blue.
Thank you all. Good night.